The Book of Moses' intertextuality with the Book of Mormon is not the normal naturalistic thing we might expect. What happened with the Book of Moses was this amazing prophetic visionary episode of just revelation coming into Joseph Smith over the months in which he worked on the Book of Moses translation. And we get entirely bold new things like the visions of Enoch and all the details on Cain and his secret combinations and the operations and workings of Satan. And these are like core themes that we find in the Book of Mormon.
Even after all these years, how much more we're continually learning about the Book of Mormon and its structure even now.
Book of Mormon studies is so cool, it really is.
It's just very puzzling.
Welcome today to Conversations with Interpreter. I'm one of your hosts, Thora Shannon.
And I'm your other host, Avram Shannon.
And today we are talking with Jeff Lindsay. Jeff Lindsay has been writing online defending the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints for over 20 years. He is currently on the board of directors for the Interpreter Foundation. Jeff has a PhD in chemical engineering and has been an associate professor, a fellow of the American Institute of Chemical Engineers since 2014, and is currently president of Planet Lindsay, LLC. He lives in Appleton, Wisconsin with his wife and near his 4 grown sons and 15 grandchildren. Welcome to the show, Jeff.
Thank you. It's really good to be here.
We're very excited to have you. So Jeff has actually explored, for years now, the connection between our Book of Moses and the Pearl of Great Price and the Book of Mormon, working through how these things work together, parallels, things like that. And his most recent contribution to this topic is a 2-part essay where he updates and thinks on these parallels. So far, right now, together, we're going to go over part 1, and then in a later show, we're going to go over part 2 and work through that. So today, we're kind of talking about methodological considerations and talking about the distribution of the various kinds of parallels that Jeff has found. As we think through this, talk to us about kind of how you got started with this.
Well, that's a great question. This began when I was living in China a number of years ago, and I was working on an article for the Interpreter Journal of Latter-day Saint Faith and Scholarship. And there was responding to a critic's denunciation of the Book of Mormon. It happened to be an intellectual member of the church who argued that the Book of First Nephi and the whole story of Lehi's trail couldn't possibly be true because it makes constant allusions to the Exodus. And many Bible scholars believe that the Exodus never happened, but was a creation to add some gravitas to the history of this small Canaanite tribe in Israel. And many good scholars strongly object to that characterization, and there's many good reasons to reject that characterization. But while I was writing my response, I needed to deal with 1 Nephi 4:2, because this verse was the one that this critic cited as an example of the Book of Mormon's erroneous reliance on the Exodus account. Let me just read that to you. I think it's a very interesting verse. Nephi is dealing with his rebellious brothers who don't want to work, don't want to help, and he's trying to encourage them to get on board with this whole journey that they're on. 1 Nephi 4:2, he says to them, Therefore, let us go up. Let us be strong, like unto Moses. For he truly spake unto the waters of the Red Sea, and they divided hither and thither. And our fathers came through out of captivity on dry ground, and the armies of Pharaoh did follow and were drowned in the waters of the Red Sea. So a very obvious allusion to the Exodus. And as I was responding to his critique, I thought, wait a second, this is kind of strange. Where does he speaks of the strength of Moses as if that was a well-known concept. And as I tried to think about what I could remember from Moses, I never recall anything about him being strong. In fact, one of the main images in my mind of Moses regarding strength is when there's a battle and he has to hold up his rod or his cane above his head, and he needs people to help him hold it up. So I'm wondering, where can I find that in the Bible? So I searched the Old Testament. I can find strength referring to all sorts of things: Pharaoh, the hand of God, various armies and forces and so forth. But Moses is never associated with strength in the Old Testament. Then I was puzzled by that, because Nephi is citing this, clearly referring to an Old Testament account, and yet I don't see strength of Moses in there. Just a minor puzzle. I just kept that in the back burner while I worked on the article, but then as I puzzled over it, I ran into and did some searches trying to find references that might help. I ran across an article by Noel B. Reynolds, where it called The Brass Plates Version of Genesis, published in 1990. And in that article, he reported doing a computer search to see what the intertextuality was between the Book of Moses and the Book of Mormon. And he found by doing computer searches, there were 33 terms, words, or phrases that were not easily explained by the King James Version that were in common between the Book of Moses and the Book of Mormon. And as he explored some of these and discussed each one of them, he found several cases where it seemed like the normal dependency we would expect, namely, Joseph Smith dictates the Book of Mormon, gets very familiar with Book of Mormon lingo, and now dictates the Book of Moses and would then bring that lingo into his translation. That's kind of a rational conclusion one might make. That normal conclusion didn't fit in several cases. In some cases, it looked like the Book of Mormon was alluding to a backstory somewhere else that seemed to be in the Book of Moses. The issue, for example, of secret combinations. There are many references to secret combinations and works of darkness in the Book of Mormon that make more sense and seem to have a backstory when we turn to the Book of Moses and Cain and his secret combinations that followed and how they persevered, how they operated. So many details about secret combinations and how they work, what their goals are, who's behind them, are given in the Book of Moses. And the Book of Mormon frequently seems to just draw upon that backstory without giving those details. And a classic one that shows this one-way directionality comes from Moses 4:4, where the book of Moses describes certain characteristics of Satan, how he lies, he's a father of lies, he blinds and deceives people to lead them into captivity. And those terms are used numerous times throughout the Book of Mormon as if they are making common allusions to something that is well known. And that directionality seems to be Book of Moses provides the backstory or key verses, and the Book of Mormon makes lots of allusions to them or relies upon them. And one of the really cool ways the Book of Mormon relies upon Moses 4:4 is in the story when Nephi is being accused by Laman. 1 Nephi 16, I believe it's verse 48. Laman is attacking Nephi. And Nephi writes it down. He writes down all the bad stuff that Laman and Lemuel have to say about him. And in verse 38 of 1 Nephi 16, now he says that the Lord has talked with him. This is the accusation of Nephi. And also that angels have ministered unto him. But behold, we know that he lies unto us, and he tells us things, and he worketh many things by his cunning arts, that he may deceive our eyes, thinking perhaps that he may now lead us away into some strange wilderness. And after he has lied to us, led us away, he has thought to make himself a king and a ruler over us, that he may do with us according to his will and pleasure. And after this manner did my brother Laman stir up their hearts to anger. Well, one of the parallels that Noel Reynolds found in his original paper involves actually a host of things from Moses 4:4, but it's all based on these concepts of Satan is the father of lies. He lies, he deceives us, he blinds our eyes to lead us away captivity according to his will. And these are the points that Laman and Lemuel are making, as if they're accusing Nephi of being satanic. And if that's the case, then capital punishment would certainly be a wise step under their law. The seriousness of Laman's charge is hidden to us when we read it until we make that connection. Oh my goodness, when you read Moses 4:4, Laman is alluding to Moses 4:4 and its characterization of Satan and using those to describe Nephi. And that's a case where there's very interesting explanatory power from this one-way directionality, Book of Moses to the Book of Mormon, where as if the Book of Moses is providing added meaning and a backstory for the Book of Moses situations. And to me, that's one of many compelling evidences that the Book of Moses' intertextuality with the Book of Mormon is not the normal naturalistic thing we might expect of Joseph learning all this text from the translation and then bringing it into the Book of Moses. It's as if he dictated a book that appears in many cases to be using language from or alluding to backstories that had not been composed yet in terms of Joseph Smith doing the translation, because the Book of Moses, of course, was done after the Book of Mormon was completed, the translation was completed, and the publication had even begun. So there's that fascinating, puzzling direction of influence, and how is that possible? And I think it's a very compelling argument that the best way to explain that is that something like the Book of Moses was on the brass plates, and that's what Noel Reynolds proposed. And that proposal, as I began studying it, has been, I think, verified in many further ways, and I'm just very impressed with that original insight that gave us this important lead. He had 33 parallels at the time, and now we're up to about 146 and maybe 47, 48 with some new things coming along. And it's just very puzzling. It's very puzzling because we're only considering Book of Moses text that's not out of the King James Bible, and that's about half the text, and it's a very small book, and yet it has such a thick denseness of parallels in the Book of Mormon. Anyway, when I saw that article Noel Reynolds had written, I said, I wonder if the Book of Moses has any insights on this issue of the strength of Moses. I didn't think of anything right off the bat, but I started reading the Book of Moses, and right away in chapter 1, there are three different indications referring to about strength. One is Moses' lack of physical strength when he had this revelation. Another, but the key one is verse 25, where the Lord tells Moses. Yeah, here it is. Moses chapter 1, verse 25. There's a couple other mentions of the word strength in his story about natural strength and so forth, but verse 25 to me is the one that really hit home. And calling upon the name of God, he beheld his glory again, for it was upon him. And he heard a voice saying, Blessed art thou, Moses, for I, the Almighty, have chosen thee, and thou shalt be made stronger than many waters, for they shall obey thy command as if thou wert God. And that is obviously...
There's a real connection there with what you said there in 1 Nephi there. Yeah.
Very, very definite connection. It's 1 Nephi introduces strength in Moses, immediately talks about Moses crossing the Red Sea. And Moses 1:25, I will make you stronger than many waters, and you will cross, they'll part at your command. That is strength. That's the strength of Moses, through his faith, able to work a mighty miracle. And I realized, my goodness, there may be something to this paper by Noel Reynolds, because here is another potential match. And that was step one. And then after that, right after that conclusion, I said, I wonder, what about the amazing vision that Enoch has, where he sees Satan, he's got angels laughing, and he's got this great chain that darkens the whole earth, and there's reference to chains of darkness, where Satan's blinding the earth. And I thought, I wonder if the Book of Mormon has anything about chains of darkness. And I was kind of disappointed, a quick search for chain and darkness together. No, it wasn't in there. But as I looked further, there were definitely references to that. Right? 2 Nephi chapter 1, Lehi is teaching his wayward sons and telling them to arise and be men and shake off these chains and come out of obscurity. And obscurity, go to the Webster's Dictionary, first definition is darkness. Obscurity is a good term for darkness. And chains of Satan, chains of darkness are alluded to, referred to in those verses. It's actually an interesting chiasm from verse 13 to 23, where both involve chains and concepts of awaking or coming out of a deep sleep or darkness. So 2 Nephi 1, 23 and 13, I found another potential parallel. This was all became part of an initial paper. And then I sent copies to Noel Reynolds and asked him for comments, and we ended up collaborating, had a very nice series of interchanges with Noel, and really just respect him, such a great person to work with. But we found a lot more, and we did another paper. So I had an initial paper that proposed 15 more, and then working with Noel Reynolds over about a year, we came up with a total of 97 parallels, and I thought, wow, we've exhausted everything, and yet then more just kept popping up, and not even necessarily looking for them, just run into them accidentally and go, oh my goodness, why is this yet another one? How do we miss that? So another paper came out where we had now 133, and this last paper, there's 15 more, or 14 more that are being presented and discussed in detail in the second part. But part one, after all that, going through the peer review process, some of the peer reviewers threw out some really good questions, like, well, are these just randomly distributed throughout the Book of Mormon? And what does this say about the translation of the Bible by Joseph Smith? Because Moses, of course, Book of Moses, which is the first part of that effort, does this continue? They asked several really good questions, and I tried to address them in this latest paper, part one, for the interpreter. And it's been a really interesting journey delving into that.
Yeah, great. Thank you.
And so as we and you alluded to, we will go through more specific examples in part two of our discussion with you, where we go over part two of your paper. But for now, let's focus more on the methodological or the questions that are brought up by these reviewers and how you answered them in this paper. Let's go through, you already alluded to one of those, but talk about some of these questions that brought up. Let's talk about the first one about the distribution of these parallels throughout the Book of Mormon. And, you know, the question of, is this random? Do certain authors or books show more of them than others? So what can you tell us about the distribution we see of these parallels throughout the Book of Mormon? And it's both authors and speakers and the books themselves.
Yes. It's really a very interesting story. If this were just random accidents, you know, Joseph Smith, just in his own vocabulary, Yankee dialect, whatever, throwing out phrases that he uses both in the Book of Mormon, later in the Book of Moses, you might expect them not to be in any kind of controlled distribution, but would be just kind of scattered randomly throughout the text. So I wanted to look at that. We already had a feeling that a lot of the really good ones seem to come from Nephi or Jacob or Alma. And we, both Noel and I had noted and observed that those guys seem to have a lot, but does it really hold up when you do the math, when you count all the chapters and verses and everything? So I tried to come up with a more precise approach in doing this. So I got a big spreadsheet, and I created columns for every chapter of the Book of Mormon, and I created so rows for all the chapters, and then columns for all the parallels that we had. So in this, with 146 parallels in this paper, we had 146 columns, and in each column, of course, I would indicate which verses from the Book of Moses were involved, which verses from the Book of Mormon were involved, and then I would put little, you know, numbers in certain squares to show, okay, this. We have an occurrence of this parallel in Alma chapter 17, so I put that number there, and then just scatter them all throughout this big spreadsheet that had chapters, every chapter, all these columns, and what I would enter was which verses in that chapter had those numbers. So with that big spreadsheet, then I did a bunch of analytics where I would count how many total parallels occur in any given chapter, or in any given book, in terms of parallels per verse or parallels per thousand words. And I would make some charts and look at the distribution, both by author or by books, by chapter, and variety of ways. So in terms of the methodology, one of the important things is making sure we exclude verses that are complete, just simply a copy of a verse or a chapter in the Bibles. There are entire chapters of Isaiah, and although they have some minor differences, I have just excluded the complete citations of Isaiah in 1st and 2nd Nephi. When Malachi, there's a chapter from Malachi is cited by the Lord, there's an initial verse introducing it. So we keep that verse, but we take out the rest of that chapter that is a quotation pretty much from the King James Version of the Bible. Likewise, 3 Nephi 12, there's one verse introducing it. So we only count that as or maybe two verses introducing it, but the rest of it is just overlap with the King James Bible, in spite of some changes that are very logical. So we just are looking at text that doesn't overlap with the King James Bible, because our definition of a parallel is something that is not easily explained by, that it is part, it's part of the Book of Mormon and a part of the Book of Mormon author's writings that is not simply explained by coming from the King James Bible. So we just, when there's an entire chapter we know is just a pure chapter from Isaiah, we're not, no sense looking at that or letting that mess up the statistics. There are some chapters where Nephi, for example, is reworking, say, Isaiah 29 with a lot of his own language, 2 Nephi 27. And we keep that whole chapter because that's still Nephi's creative work, even though a lot of the words are clearly coming from Isaiah. So we're looking for things, though, that are not straight from the King James Bible or terms or phrases that are unique between the Book of Mormon and Book of Moses that can't be explained by the King James Bible. So we have lots of chapters, lots of numbers. We go through all that, and we come up with a variety of charts. And there's such an interesting story because the charts do confirm, the data confirms, that those people familiar with the brass plates, that would be Nephi, Jacob, and possibly some other small plates writers, but those, and Lehi, of course, who's quoted in Nephi's writing. These people very familiar with the brass plates, including Alma also, and King Benjamin to some degree, and King Mosiah. But the people familiar with the brass plates, they're the ones who are having all these citations or common language, common themes with the Book of Moses. A very interesting vacuum in the record is when you get to the Book of Mosiah and you get to the plates of Zenith and it's just nothing. There's none. When normally many chapters have 1, 2, 3 parallels, but when you hit Zenith's writing and from the city of, from his descendants also, they're not familiar with the brass plates. They're not bringing that brass plates material in. When Abinadi's preaching though, boom, shoots up, you get a lot of parallels. When prophets are preaching and teaching, we get a lot of parallels. In Alma's book, which has quite a lot of parallels, when he starts writing about, or when Mormon's summarizing things about the war material, no, very few parallels in that region. So there's some deserts and there's some thick forest of parallels. And they do tell a story. It makes sense. They are from, especially when they're coming from people that are familiar with the brass plates. What's interesting is I would expect, just from me myself, thinking my personal views, I would expect 3 Nephi to be really high because here's the Lord teaching and he'll surely be teaching all the great things that we have in, you know, the vision of Enoch and so forth. But actually, 3 Nephi has relatively few. It's much lower than Nephi's writings or Jacob's writings. And likewise, Mormon and Moroni, even though they bring in a lot of parallels when they start talking about secret combinations or quoting some of the thoughts of Nephi, their writings are also relatively low, which is interesting. But the people that grew up with those brass plates have lots of references to them in their writing, especially Nephi and Jacob. And of course, Lehi when he's being quoted by Nephi. And that's part of the story. To me, it's very interesting. One of the interesting things is a measure how many verses in a book, what fraction of verses have parallels. When you look at 1 Nephi and 2 Nephi and Jacob, we have up to as high as 16% of the, what I would say, qualified verses, verses that are not from a obvious citation of Isaiah. Here's a chart showing that. This is a value, I call it R1 in the paper, but it is a measure of the fraction of the verses in a book that contain parallels to the Book of Moses.
Now, some of our listeners won't be able to see that. Can you tell them about what they would be looking at if they could see it?
Yes, this is a bar graph, and it starts with, has columns for, so it's a column chart, you could say. This starts with 1 Nephi, has all the books up to Moroni, and then there's a bar rising up that gives this fraction of verses that are involved in parallels. And the scale on the left, on the y-axis, ranges from 0 to 0.16 is where the highest score is. So 1 Nephi, we have above 0.14. 2 Nephi jumps up even higher to 0.16. Jacob comes down to about 0.13. Enos, which is a very small text, so it's not statistically significant. We don't have a lot to work with. It has one verse in the book, and that gives it an R score, R1 score of about 0.03. Jerem has four parallels, and he jumps up to 0.14. Omni plummets back to 0.06. Words of Mormon, very low, even lower, about a little less than 0.06. Mosiah comes up a little higher, but remember, half of Mosiah is a vacuum where we're getting into the story from the city of Nephi and the writings of Zenith and Limhi. Where's the Mormons low? Mosiah comes back. Okay, so Mosiah comes back up. Alma is up a high, no, it's about 0.07. We get much higher in Helaman, where it jumps up to about 0.12. And that's because Helaman has a lot of secret combinations, words of darkness, secret murder themes that are found in the Book of Moses, and very heavy density of those concepts. Third Nephi comes back down, fourth Nephi a bit lower. Mormon is perhaps the lowest of all, just barely, anyway, barely above 0.03.
So on that list, as you go into those numbers, okay, Nephi we expect, whatever, Jacob we expect, as you say, Abinadi, but Jerem seems unusually high for how we usually talk about Jerem in, can you talk about that for a second? You mentioned a little bit in your paper there. What's going on with Jerem? Why is he so high? Because he's kind of this mission drift kind of thing going on with that.
Yeah, an interesting thing about Jerem, it's just recently published in the book of, or in the journal, Interpreter, is Jerem is actually a beautiful example of a complicated chiasmus, a very large chiasmus. And he's writing in a very, I would say, a very literary way, a lot of rhetorical tools. And when people are getting really talking about gospel themes and being careful and doing these sophisticated rhetorical tools, they tend to turn to the scriptures a lot. And I think that's why we have, and it could be chance, it's such a small book, but we've got higher than normal density of parallels in Jerem.
So we may have undersold Jerem here in our reading of scripture, that maybe he's got, there's more going on there than we've traditionally read in the Book of Mormon there in the small place, you think?
That would be a fair statement.
So this is really interesting, and I feel like we could just keep going along this line, but before our time is up, we'd also love to talk a little bit about some of the other questions that you answer during your paper for part one. So can you talk a little bit, you did already allude to this, about Joseph Smith's translation and how you feel like it's very clear that it's one way from the Book of Moses to the Book of Mormon, although the order of translation went from Book of Mormon to Book of Moses for Joseph Smith. Could you talk a little bit more about that and about how your conclusions you reached to show that how the Book of Mormon is clearly drawing on the Book of Moses and not the other way around?
Oh, before we go on, I'd just like to mention it was Stephen Ehat who was the author of this excellent paper exploring Jerem and its chiastic structure that I think helps show what a serious work of literature this book is.
Excellent.
Yeah, that's a great mention. It's interesting to see, even after all these years, how much more we're continually learning about the Book of Mormon and its structure even now.
Book of Mormon studies is so cool. It really is.
And such, relatively speaking, compared to biblical studies, such a new field. There's so much we're still learning. So with that in mind, can you go on to talking about Joseph Smith and the Joseph Smith translation?
Okay, that's a great question. It's very natural to suspect that this process might have continued throughout the Joseph Smith translation because Book of Moses was just the first part. He was just translating up to Genesis 6:13, and then he went on up to Genesis 24 and then did the New Testament and then came back to the Old Testament. So we have a lot of material in the Joseph Smith translation. So to explore that, I relied on the text by Kenneth and Lyndall Lutz. This is the Joseph Smith translation, and it's a very nice text because it just shows in bold where things have changed and leaves out chapters that aren't touched, so it's very concentrated. You can go through and quickly see what's been changed and compare it to, say, the Book of Mormon. As I went through that process, I was really surprised to see there is a very, like, an abrupt transition. Those first six chapters of Genesis, as they're translated, giving what's the first chapter one, which is the visions of Moses, as it originally called, and not from any chapter, really, but after that comes chapter one, chapter two, and so on. I found very little after the Book of Moses translation. And there are a couple of exceptions. Genesis 50 has a lot of material in common with 2 Nephi 3, where we have this term fruit of his loins and prophecy of Joseph in the future and coming forth of the Book of Mormon. But as you examine it, it looks like it can largely be explained by copying text from the book of, already existing Book of Mormon into that translation. With some changes. And Isaiah 29 also has some strong connections to the Book of Mormon, but again, it looks like Book of Mormon language was just put in kind of verbatim in many, many verses into that translation. And we do have some evidence that Joseph Smith actually opened up the Book of Mormon in doing some of that translation. So it almost looks like what happened with the Book of Moses was this amazing prophetic, visionary episode of just revelation coming into Joseph Smith over the months in which he worked on the Book of Moses translation. And we get entirely bold new things like the visions of Enoch and all the details on Cain and his secret combinations and the operations and workings of Satan. And these are like core themes that we find in the Book of Mormon. After that, after he finished that first burst of revelatory new scripture being given, it looks like the bulk of his work was making logical, reasonable corrections, and I'm not saying not inspired at all.
Of course not.
There's definitely some inspired, a lot of great inspiration and some new material that's there, but it doesn't share the intertextuality that we have with the Book of Mormon, as if maybe those changes were not necessarily influencing Book of Mormon writers or on the brass plates version that they had. I don't know. Likewise, the New Testament, there's a lot of amazing, beautiful material there, but we don't see strong evidence that that was present in what they had, or what maybe, certainly not on the brass plates, but even after Christ came and ministered, we don't see a lot of overlap in that Joseph Smith translation of the New Testament. So the conclusion that I came to after examining this is that there was something really special and unique as new scripture was being created during the translation of those first few chapters of Genesis. And then after that, it was still an inspired process, but not the same nature of scripture that was on the brass plates for the writers of the Book of Mormon.
Well, thank you so much. Our time is up for now. So we're really grateful we could talk to you about this distribution of how we see it in the Book of Mormon, these parallels between the Book of Mormon and the Book of Moses, and also about Joseph Smith.
Kind of for just one last thought here. So what's the one great big takeaway that you think readers of the Book of Mormon or the Book of Moses should take away from your work?
There's something really surprising and special about both of these books. To me, the best way I can think of explaining it, and this is just my theory, is that while Book of Mormon writers had access to a text like the Book of Moses on the ancient brass plates that they had, there was still some kind of miraculous guidance in the translation process that helped flag these relationships, because common language is often used and it doesn't have to be used to convey similar meaning. So it almost is like there was a divine process in both the Book of Moses generation and the Book of Mormon generation to make it possible to see the Book of Moses as a key text that influenced Book of Mormon writers. And putting all this together, to me, it only makes sense if both of these have ancient origins. If the Book of Moses really had some analog that existed anciently on the brass plates that influenced those Book of Mormon writers who were most familiar with those brass plates. And to me, the bottom line is it helps strengthen my personal testimony that both the Book of Mormon and the Book of Moses have divine and ancient origins. And I think that's worth people, a hypothesis at least worth exploring as people look at these for themselves and compare the beautiful teachings of the Book of Moses with the beautiful teachings of the Book of Mormon and see those connections that I think were meant for us to recognize.
Thank you. I think that's a great thing to end on and something for us, help for all of us to remember as we go forward. Thank you so much.
Thanks for being with us.
Okay. Thank you for caring about this. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of Conversations with Interpreter. To read the articles and scholarship discussed today, visit interpreterfoundation.org. Be sure to subscribe and share this episode with others who seek learning by study and by faith.